guest tonight is John Potash. He is the author of Drugs as Weapons Against Us. His first book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, was published in 2007. John completed graduate studies at Columbia University. He is a journalist who has been published in the Baltimore Chronicle, the City Paper, Covert Action, and other publications. He also works as a counselor helping people with mental health and addiction issues. John, how are you doing tonight?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Tim.
Thank you for coming on. Is there anything else you want to add to that intro?
No, just that the book Drugs as Weapons Against Us is subtitled The CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lenin, Cobain, Tupac, and Other Activists, just so people get a broad understanding of what the book covers.
Okay. And well, let's get in the book. I know I'm reading it now. I wasn't able to finish it. But I'm familiar with the work, and I know you get into the book opens up with one thing is the opium trade, the narcotics trafficking, and its role in the rise of the American oligarchy, the financial elite in this country. Do you want to get into that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, to me, one of the most interesting things is just the start of, you know, how the oligarchy came to be was through the drug trade. And it started with the Anglophiles. There was a group of families in the United States that were actually really traitors to the American, you know, Revolution. But because they were so in love with the British, and they were working and dealing with the British. And one of their dealings with the British was to ship opium with the British East India Company. And so that group, some of the families were the Russells, the Cabots, the Lowes, and Perkins, the Pierponts, and a lot of them were intermarried. And so the Russells happened to be the biggest opium traders, though, but a lot of them also started the Ivy League colleges. Like the Russells were big founders of Yale, the Lowes of, like, they have Low Library at Columbia University where I went to, and they all founded really the Ivy League colleges. And so they made their big money off this opium shipping. And then when you came up to, in my first chapter, I come up to the mid-1800s, they were getting that money out of, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, that opium out of India and the area near the Golden Triangle. And they were trying to get it into China. And China didn't like what was going on with their population getting so opiated. And they tried to ban opium and ban the trade. And so wealthy British opium traders, the British East India Company, got the British Army to fight a war, an opium war for them. You know, it's the first official opium war against China. And then a second one also in the mid-1800s. And that forced the Chinese to accept the opium. And it was at that same time that they were using the opium in Britain. And they were popularizing opium in Britain, and they were commercializing it into morphine and then into heroin. And they were doing that at the same time as labor unrest around the Industrial Revolution. And I argue it's a two-edged sword. They use it to exploit other countries, but they also use it to exploit their own workers and quell unrest in their own country amongst their own populace. And that's, of course, where you get the famous Marx saying, you know, the religion is the opiate of the masses, that actually, puts more weight on the opium as a tool against the masses, even more than religion. So that's how I show that it was used as a weapon in the first chapter. And that group, those two groups, both in Britain and England, I mean, Britain and the United States, but of course, I focus more on the United States. The United States, they really rose because of the historical evolution of the United States being different than the European countries. In the European countries, when they rose up, these nouveau riche of, you know, opium dealers and different industrialists, there was a bit of a power struggle between the aristocrats and the royalty against the nouveau riche. In the United States, when they rose up, there was no royalty to oppose them, so they became oligarchs with much more control quickly. And that's why we evolved into not having national health care and such expensive colleges and so many other rights that European countries have. But in the U.S., the Russells, you know, intermarried with the Pierponts, gave birth to J.P. Morgan, you know, Julius Pierpont Morgan. And of course, Julius Pierpont Morgan was one of the wealthiest men in the world. They also, now the Russells founded Skull and Bones at Yale University. And the other opium shipping families founded the secret societies in their Ivy League colleges. And at those secret societies, like Skull and Bones, you had the Carnegies come out of there. You had Daniel Coit Gilman come out of there. You had the Rockefellers coming out of there. And they were bequeathed what's about today about $225,000 upon graduating from Skull and Bones and Yale, graduating from Yale University and the Skull and Bones Society. And so they started out with an incredible amount of money to gain even more money, later in life and just take over the upper echelons of society. And so many of the wealthiest families started out that way, and I just show all of them. And then, ended up the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgans and the Carnegies actually became, some of the wealthiest families that, particularly J.P. Morgan and Rockefellers, that ended up buying up a lot of the media, a lot of the magazines and the newspapers, and which gained them even more control over society. And then that led up to the eugenics movement, which was the most racist, genocidal movement this country's ever seen. According to Edwin Black, who was a syndicated columnist for the Chicago, I think Chicago Times, Chicago Tribune, he was nominated for a 10, I think it was the Pulitzer Prize 10 times. He's, his books are incredible. When World War II, War Against the Weak, is about the eugenics movement leading up to World War II, and his most famous book is probably IBM and the Holocaust. But Black documented how the eugenics movement was started by this Daniel Coit Gilman, who was working for the Carnegie Institution. He also happened to found Johns Hopkins University, Daniel Coit Gilman. And Gilman started the actually started the Russell Foundation, which first bequeathed the incredible amounts of money to Skull and Bones graduates, and then helped found the eugenics movement on behalf of the Carnegies. And then the J.P. Morgans and the Rockefellers contributed to it, and then they contributed to the rise of the Nazis. And so the eugenics movement in the United States played out in Nazi Germany. But of course, in the defeat of Nazi Germany, they took on a new project, which was the CIA. And actually, and they took on the CIA's one of the CIA's project biggest projects was Project MKUltra, which was run in the same eugenics laboratory in the New York area, Cold Spring Harbor. And I argue that that's no coincidence. It was because they were working out of there before the start of the CIA and MKUltra with the eugenics movement. So that's all in basically my first chapter, and then MKUltra starts in about my second chapter, and from there on, MKUltra is kind of the umbrella for the rest of the book.
That's a good summation of the. You explained well the sort of the, I guess you'd say the milieu, or the culture of the oligarchs and how they viewed the world, their sort of worldview, and how they sort of, I guess, even in their day, formed a breakaway civilization, so to speak. They didn't see themselves as being among the masses. They were the elite, and they needed to. Secure their wealth and amass more wealth and gain control of society. And as you alluded to, buying up the universities, controlling education, and also controlling the media, what you're doing is you're creating that's perception management, I guess. And
Oh,
you,
yeah,
yeah.
sure.
Of course, there's also with the development of a lot of this is technology with the development of mass media with radio, then Hollywood, and then of course television. Now, with the web and wireless technology, all this, although we're exploring that technology right now to have this conversation, it's also an incredible tool for control and manipulation.
Oh, sure. They buy out. They certainly have the upper hand on all technologies and buy out so many of the new technologies. And the CIA and the military industrial complex keeps under wraps, the most advanced technology, and only lets out a little bit of what they think will help them further their own cause, really.
Yeah, well, even the platforms that most people use today to communicate and talk, like Facebook, that's InQtel, that's CIA. I would say probably all of the telecom companies are attached to the hip to the to National Security Agency and CIA. Yeah. The software programs with the back doors, how Windows 10, or even if you look at the origins of Silicon Valley, people have done research how, rather than being sort of these free-willing cowboys, experimenting LSD and being all creative because of it, I think it's more of a, we'll get into the marketing angle later on with celebrities. But even that with Stuart Brandt, people have done research tracing the fact of these people. The whole notion of the PC internet, of course, that came out of DARPA, is although again, although in the meantime, it has been used to spread a lot of information, educate a lot of people. It's also because of it, because of the digital technology, it's a mass surveillance platform too.
Yeah, it's interesting that so you saw me mention Stuart Brand in the book, huh?
No, I haven't got that far yet, but I'm familiar with the case. But I mean, again, it's just what if people done research. I'm looking forward to see what's your take on him.
Yeah, he was part of the Merry Pranksters, and it's interesting. I saw interviews of him where he like recent interviews of him, within the last 10 years, 15 years, where he is so pro-nuclear, and it's just incredible. This guy pretends to be such an environmentalist and is so pro-nuclear. That's such a joke to me. There's no way nuclear could be pro-environment, and so this guy. His history, he says this openly in these interviews that he was in the military and had a pretty high up position in the military as like a battalion leader or some kind of officer. And he was regularly in the early 1960s going into Lower East Side of New York and basically spreading drugs around, spreading acid around there.
Oh, so he's part of that program, yeah.
Yeah, he was part of that, and that was the MKUltra program. And this was not, I do not believe this was a coincidence or random. He was doing it on the weekends, while he was in the military. And then he goes out to the West Coast and joins the Merry Pranksters. And who's he doing it with? He's doing it with Ken Babbs, who was the first officer to enter Vietnam, the helicopter pilot. And that again, I argue that is no coincidence. I show all the evidence how that is no coincidence. And so when Ken Kesey wanted to stop the acid test after about the, I think it was the second or third acid test, he said he wanted to end the acid test. He wanted people to graduate from acid and not have any more. All of a sudden, he's arrested for a second time and he's threatened to be held in jail long term. And, the acid tests get bigger. They hold the Trips Festival, make it three times as big for much bigger than even was than the last acid test was. And who held that Trips Festival? It was Ken Babbs and Stuart Brand, two military guys. And that Trips Festival was high technology. It attracted incredible amount of people, thousands of people, and it was acid everywhere. And who was at that Trips Festival? The top MKUltra psychologist, John Gittinger, according to his own legal deposition. He said he was there with two other MKUltra scientists. And he was at about two other acid tests with fellow MKUltra scientists. So that and much more evidence points to the fact that that these acid tests were actually MKUltra operations, just like they were on the East Coast where Timothy Leary was running, was holding these parties just above New York City in Millbrook Mansion of William Mellon Hitchcock. And the Mellon Hitchcocks owned Gough Oil, Mellon Bank, Carnegie Mellon University they started. And there's some of the wealthiest, some of the one of the wealthiest families in the world. And they also were parts of the U.S. intelligence, high level U.S. intelligence. So that's the history of that. And of course, William Mellon Hitchcock and his sister Peggy Mellon Hitchcock start the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which becomes the biggest LSD trafficking group in the world. So that's just part of it, yeah.
Yeah, they pretty much dominated the Office of Strategic Services, right? That
Yeah,
family. Yeah.
Mellons were big in the Office of Strategic Services, which was whose director was Alan Dulles, who was one of the lawyers for the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgan interests. Yeah, and so and those were the interests that were funding the Nazis, along with IBM and Ford and et cetera. So it was actually somewhat of a kind inter civil war in the United States, where and in Britain too, where you had part of Britain actually fighting the Nazis and part of Britain trying to help fund the Nazis behind the back. Brown Brothers Harriman was, part of Brown Brothers Harriman was, I think it was Governor Brown, it was the head of the Bank of England, doing stuff behind the back of Winston Churchill. So it's incredible history.
That's right. And Helmut Schacht, the German central banker, was good friends with Montague Norman. And
Yes, it was Montague Norman was head, I think, of the Bank of England, who was and but Brown was one of the wealthiest people in England that was working with the Harrimans.
I think at that level, that meta level, why the I guess why the grunts are made to storm Normandy Beach and die on some awful rock out in the South Pacific, Japanese and Americans. Like at that level, the they're managing the conflict to make as much money, and also to reorder the world, rebuild the world. That's what you get out of both world wars were kind of, I think, were at least at a meta level directed at some level. I'm not quite sure how much, whether it's there's suspicion regarding Hitler and the Hitler Project, and that factors into British geostrategy, weakening Germany and getting them to fight with Russia and.
Yeah, I think we're I mean, we're going on a tangent from the drugs as weapons against us theme, but I know what you're saying there. And the thing about it is Dulles then, becomes a CIA director, and he's running MK Ultra, Operation MK Ultra. And so MK Ultra is then testing at least 2 dozen different drugs on over 1,000 Edgewood Arsenal soldiers, to use these drugs as unconventional for unconventional warfare, according to their documents. And I show the evidence that this unconventional warfare was not just in the battlefield, but it was against any dissent in the United States or England against their war policies. And then, so then you lead up to the fact that what was the two longest wars in American history, and it was the Vietnam War and the Afghanistan War. And why was it? And what's the coincidence between those two wars? The Vietnam War was in the Golden Triangle for opium fields, the best place in the world to grow op poppies, which produce opium and produce heroin. And then Afghanistan was the other, was the Golden Crescent of opium, of poppy fields to, produce opium and heroin. And John Stockwell told me in 1990, when I talked to him after a conference, and he was a CIA station chief, he said that he was personally flying heroin out of Vietnam into the United States. And his fellow CIA officers were doing the same thing. And they told him in the late 1980s that they then took their operations for trafficking heroin over to the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, where they were, the Golden Crescent, where they continued that up until, at least the early 90s, if not beyond.
The Vietnam War, I think, at least one of the main call or motivations behind it were well, one thing you had the military contracts. It's called helicopters and heroin. All the people making money off Cameron Bay, dredging the bay there, building the airfields, the weaponry, and all that. And then you have the heroin, which goes back to OSS operations in the CIA in the 50s. How they kind of nudged the French out, and
The
that was
French and the the French and the Americans were fighting over the poppy fields of
more specifically the Corsicans.
Well, the Corsicans were used by them to help to be the middlemen of it all.
And according to Doug Valentine, that's what Ellsberger's really doing over there.
Oh, really?
And his whistleblowing was at best a limited hangout to blame the conflict on the Pentagon. And give the CIA cover because it really was a CIA operation up until 1964 when you had the escalation.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I didn't realize that Valentine said that. I've talked to Valentine a few times recently, just in brief, because we both had the same publisher, Trinday, and we were just talking about different stuff around that. But I like Valentine's stuff. I quote some of his material in my book.
He has a new book coming out this fall about the CIA being the biggest drug dealer in the world.
Well, good. I hope he sheds new information that I don't already have out there, but good for him.
But you have these drug, you mentioned Vietnam and Afghanistan, coincidentally being the two longest wars and also being heavily involved with heroin. Of course, At least as a World War II, you have the OSS with the Luciano Project, working
Yeah, right.
with gangsters supposedly to fight, Nazi Germany and Italy. This to help with the, I guess, the Italian campaign. But they're working with the mob, mafia, with the mafia there in Italy,
Sure.
for supposedly for the war effort. But of course, because of that, they let Luciano out of prison and deported him. But they gave him sort of this franchise over there to ship heroin through the Marseille ports into New York. This was the famous French Connection.
Right. And they've always used ethnic criminal groups as their middlemen, and so that they can then just come down on them when they do, or then use them as a go-between and as cover for their own operations. So, for example, like William Pepper, when he covered Martin Luther King's assassination, he said that the CIA and FBI went to the top mafia families in New York and offered them $1 million to kill Martin Luther King, to assassinate Martin Luther King, and they actually rejected it. But the mafia, Martin King of the kind of Texas New Orleans area, Marcello, took that contract. And so now I argue in one chapter of my book that the four biggest assassinations of the 1960s, the Kennedys and MLK and Malcolm X, have one thing in common. One major thing in common is that they were the four biggest voices against the Vietnam War, and that's just one of the reasons for their assassination. Of course, there were other reasons for their assassination, but one of them was because they were the biggest voices opposing the takeover of the best poppy fields for heroin production in the world. And so after that, of course, I go into how the acid and other psychedelics and other drugs were used to quell dissent against the Vietnam War, but also to quell racial dissent too. And of course, the heroin was brought in to quell quell kind of civil rights movements and racial dissent in the United States, because they clearly showed the evidence of how they targeted ethnic communities, and particularly communities of color, with all that heroin, and then later, of course, with cocaine. But they particularly targeted the white radical groups with acid and shrooms and weed and all that. But so that was a huge part of MKUltra. Now, how did they do that? They used musicians to promote it, and so that's a core of my book too, obviously. And I just show how, for example, in 1965, now A.E. Hotchner was a longtime friend and a one-time editor of Ernest Hemingway. And he wrote a great book called Blown Away about the Rolling Stones. And a few pages of that book cover MKUltra, believe it or not. He says in 1965, Robert Lashbrook, deputy director of MKUltra, went over to London with loads of LSD, loads of agents, and loads of money, and directed agents to get acid in as many musicians' hands as possible. Now the question is why? And the obvious answer is to promote it to youth, and youth that could be get involved in protests. They were already involved in civil rights protests, and they were starting to get more and more into anti-war protests, anti-Vietnam War protests. And so, that same year, the strangest, incident around in London happened, where John Lennon and George Harrison are invited over to dinner to George Harrison's dentist, a guy named Riley, the dentist, Dr. Riley. Him and his Playboy wife have them over for dinner, and at the end of the dinner, they say, "Oh, you can't leave yet." They wanted to rush out to see a friend's band. They say, "No, you can't leave yet. You have to have this dessert and coffee. We got this great coffee." So they're like, "All right, we'll stay for the coffee," and they dose each of their, John Lennon and George Harrison's drink with LSD, and so John Lennon was furious, and George Harrison said, "What's LSD? Never even heard of it at that time." And so why would a dentist risk his career, risk his livelihood, risk not being sued by these wealthy musicians to do this? And I argue because he was an extension of that Robert Lashbrook MKUltra operation brought over to London. And what happened 2 years later? Mick Jagger was a holdout from using LSD. So who gives him his first hit of acid at a party? A guy named Schneiderman, who was an undercover FBI agent. And this is according to the, London Daily newspapers, who talked about his connections to both FBI and MI6, or I think it was MI5 actually, which is the British FBI. And so he gives Mick Jagger his first hit of acid. And when the police come in to the party where he'd given Jagger the hit of acid, only Jagger and Keith Richards get arrested, and this guy Schneiderman, who's got a briefcase full of drugs, is let go. He's let out of there, and he's and so then Jagger and Keith Richards were under legal authority's thumb. I argue that similar stuff happened to Brian Jones, and so but meanwhile, John Lennon, he was furious about the first time he ate acid. But they get so many agents and so many people around them trying to get him to try acid again. And it was pushed so hard in the United States with the incredible ownership of so much media. And it was pushed in the media as this underground phenomenon. It was pushed on so many celebrities by psychiatrists. MKUltra's, agents were pushing it all over the United States and all over the world, really. But particularly hard in the United States with those acid tests I told you about, with Timothy Leary being in the spotlight all the time, with the Millbrook Mansion and being funded and it being popularized by Time Incorporated's magazines, who, of course, we know was working hand in hand with the CIA. That's been published one, by Carl Bernstein. It came out in the Senate Church Committee that Time Incorporated was working hand in hand with the CIA, but most actually, the owners of most major media were working hand in hand with the CIA, according to the Senate Church Committee. And Carl Bernstein merely re-reported it again, but he could only get it published in Rolling Stone magazine, his seminal article, CIA in the Media. So they were popularizing it like hugely in the United States. And I argue the way they got John Lennon and George Harrison to use acid a second time, their second time was at the home of at a home owned by David Crosby of the Byrds. And this guy named Dave McGowan, I don't know if you ever heard of the researcher Dave McGowan.
Yes, I pleasure of interviewing him last year, just
Right.
before he was got his diagnosis.
Right. Yeah, he did incredible work, I think, with Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. Though I actually even like even better his earlier book, Programmed to Kill.
Yeah, it's a great book too.
Yeah,
Read
but
both of them.
Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon was particularly important. And I talk about it in my book because it had, they had so many musicians. They just gave instant popularity to so many musicians whose, parents were high level military or high level in the, part of the oligarchy. Crosby came from the Van Cortlandt family, which people from New York know from Van Cortlandt Parkway and just some of the, and the Rensselaers and all that, those were Crosby's family. He was from an oligarchical family. And they all seemed to, rise up in this one little area of Los Angeles called Laurel Canyon. And they were given like instant fame over there. And what else is in Laurel Canyon? The biggest movie studio in the world, really, put out tens of thousands of movies, but it was an Air Force studio, Air Force film studio, called Lookout Mountain Studio. So there was loads of undercover agents there working there, and some of the biggest film stars were working there, and they were also showing up at these Laurel Canyon parties. So John Lennon takes his second hit of acid while being peer pressured by a bunch of these musicians that were tied to the military industrial complex and the oligarchy, where they're where they were having these drug and sex parties constantly. And that's what I argue that was for. That was to influence some of these musicians that weren't tied to the oligarchy, to get them to keep using acid, even though it was against their better interests. And so there, that's when they got the Beatles tripping more and more and popularizing, LSD a lot. And then you had the Who popularizing it, and a lot of other bands popularizing it. And it wasn't so hard to spread it like crazy. And Who was the top acid trafficker in the world? That was a guy named Ron Stark, who Italian governmental commission found was working with the U.S. intelligence since 1960, and he had several acid factories in several continents. And a high-level, British police inspector found that he had manufactured literally somewhere in the vicinity of 50 to 100 million hits of acid. It's incredible what was going on with the intelligence agencies and spreading acid to divert dissent and hurt the minds of these protesters and quell dissent a bit.
Yes, a good quote I have here from MKUltra Dr. Louis Jolyon West. He happened to consult or meet with Jack Ruby, Patty Hearst, Sirhan Sirhan, and I think Timothy McVeigh later in his career.
Yeah, I quoted some of this from him too. I mean, I talked about him in my book also, yeah.
He said, of drugs in hallucinations, behavior, experience, and theory. I think this is 1975.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, sure.
So I'll turn this off. I would wish I knew how. There we go.
There you go. And he said the drug. He basically talked drugs as a means of a drug prohibition as a means of social control. This is the drug war.
And, I'm so sorry about
that's
that.
Okay.
I wish I just knew how to turn this thing off. Not so bad. Yeah, I got the volume off, I think. Yeah.
but this good summation is the role.
I'm sorry, interviews. Leave it. Call back and leave a message. Okay. There we go.
Says the role of drugs in the exercise of political control is coming under increasing discussion. Control could be through prohibition or supply. That's interesting. The total, even partial prohibition of drugs gives the government considerable leverage for other types of control. An example would be selective application of drug laws against selected components of the population, such as members of certain minority groups or political organizations, or celebrities or rock stars or black people, right? I mean, so there you have it. That's Dr. Louis Jolyon West, and he was directly tied to MKUltra.
Right, and he stationed himself in Haight-Ashbury.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was many MKUltra agents, undercover agents, in Haight-Ashbury, according to Martin Lee and Bruce Schlein in their book Acid Dreams, which is an excellent book when the spread of acid to quell dissent.
Yeah, there was that first. There was what Operation Midnight Climax.
Yeah.
With that Bureau of Narcotics,
George Hunter White.
Yeah, who was really CIA, I guess.
Yeah,
I guess they moved from like, they moved on. They had this so-called safe house where they had prostitutes pick up Johns and dose them and film what went on. But then I think what was clear as the 60s wore on, they started mass dosing. That was the function of these rock festivals, these Dionysian rock festivals.
The acid test turned into the Trips Festival, turned into the Human Beings, which then turned into the rock festivals, right? And these people connected to the oligarchy that Dave McGowan documented a bit of in Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon basically started these that first festival in 1967 in the San Francisco area, whose name just leaves me all of a sudden. But it was a great festival, but it also had tons of psychedelic rock bands, and it spread acid like crazy.
You're talking about Monterey Pop?
Yeah, Monterey Pop, right. Yeah. And so, Phillips of the Mamas and Papas, John Phillips, was one of the ones who was like kind of a coordinator of Monterey Pop. And what's his history? His history is his daughter says that he had sex with her for about 10 years. You know, he is a sick guy. And he's got incredible history, he was also part of that scene in Laurel Canyon. Now Mama Cass was actually a talented woman, and she kind of turned on that whole scene and became more politically active and then died young because of it. And that's the general pattern you find of a lot of these musicians, that when they start to rebel against the manipulation to promote the drugs and they sober up and get more activists, like the founder of the Rolling Stones, Brian Jones, they're then done away with. Mm-hmm. So, eyewitnesses said, according to A.E. Hotchner, that editor, one-time editor of Ernest Hemingway, in Blown Away, he says that Brian Jones's good friend, a guy named Fitzgerald, who was part of the Guinness Beer family, saw his friend Brian Jones getting drowned in his own swimming pool, and was threatened to not talk about it or he'd be next, And so that's the general pattern you see with many of these musicians. That once they start sobering up and turning into activists, they're done away with. Now, the only one that I talk about that's different than that, that doesn't fit into that pattern, is Paul Robeson. He was just this incredible activist from early on, this absolutely brilliant man who could speak over 20 languages, was graduated from Columbia Law School, was a world-class athlete, top singer in the world. And the Paul Robeson Jr., Paul Robeson's son, has said in many lectures that he thinks CIA operatives basically dosed Paul Robeson's drink at a party and got him, they had him tripping against his will, and they kept dosing him. And when Paul Robeson Jr. went over to Russia, where it happened, to see what happened to his father, he got dosed also with acid or BZ, a super psychedelic. But that just basically hurt his mind, and then they convinced Paul Robeson's wife to let him go into a mental health hospital to get better. And then they gave him about 50 ECT treatments, electroconvulsive shock treatments, that ruined his mind and ruined him for good. So they effectively neutralized him.
If you study MKUltra, you realize that virtually every major psychiatric institution was compromised, used.
Oh,
So,
it's horrible. It's
I
so
mean,
sad. Yeah.
you and Cameron, instead of the World Psychological Association,
Right.
right?
Right. In Montreal. Yeah, it's very sad that one radio broadcaster that interviewed me said his mother was a victim of Ewan Cameron and McGill. Yeah, in the Montreal.
And that was financed through the Human Ecology Fund of the CIA.
CIA front company, out of Cornell University. And it funded, gave grants to professors at, over 100 different colleges, 100 different universities around the nation. Yeah, that was Timothy Leary's first grant, where he first actually just only used psychedelic mushrooms, but then a British operative named Hollingshead convinced him to try LSD and gave him a 3-day dose of LSD all at once, and turned his mind a little into a bit of jelly to then, kind of manipulate him thereafter.
Now, one objective here is the opiate generation, the youth,
Right.
and going into the 60s, the music is being utilized, the pop culture, just the demographics of the age lend itself to a post-war prosperity, these things. So you have a lot of young people going to college, discretionary income, these things. But another angle of this is not just opiating a generation, it's also creating a strategy of tension and dividing the generations, which used to not be so divided. And this was a function of entertainment in general, creating youth music as opposed to, music we all listen to. And this was what was created with popular music. But one thing is the political exploitation of this is how, whether it's the Manson, the crazy hippie meme with Charles Manson, although that seems like it had something to do with drugs as well, is this scared the heck out of the white middle class. And so certain politicians could take advantage of this. This was Nixon's silent majority. They kind of coalesced to become Nixon's silent majority. And so this is being manipulated, at least with electoral politics. But I have a quote here from John Ehrlichman. And he said, "You want to know what this was really about?" Ehrlichman, who died in 1999, said, referring to Nixon's declaration of the war on drugs, "The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand that what I'm, you know, understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about drugs? Of course we did." So.
And and that's what it was all a huge lie. It was all just the use of drugs as a political tool. And what you were talking about with racial dissent and anti-war sentiments and all that, and fighting both groups—that's why Jimi Hendrix was such a target and such an enemy of the state. Because when Martin Luther King was assassinated, Jimi Hendrix it politicized Jimi Hendrix in a huge way. He formally had rejected entreaties by the Black Panthers. But after Martin Luther King's assassination, he dedicated his last album to the Black Panthers. He talked about the Black Panthers in interviews, promoting them. He wanted to start an anti-war movement and get Bob Dylan to be part of it. And so that's why Jimi Hendrix had to be done away with. And but Jimi Hendrix had gotten his start in Britain, and who wormed his way into his management with a guy named Mike Jeffrey, who was, quote unquote, a former MI6 agent, which is British CIA. And Mike, within 48 hours of firing Mike Jeffrey, Jimi Hendrix died. And so they tried to promote drugs through Hendrix. And when Hendrix started sobering up and then got out of the control of British and US intelligence by firing Mike Jeffrey, he died. Now, he tried to pretend like it was an overdose on heroin or pills and all kinds of things, and the, saying he was drug crazed. But within the last few years, his Jimi Hendrix's roadie, James Tappy Wright, came out with a memoir saying that Mike Jeffrey actually admitted having Hendrix killed. So, it's just obvious what was going on there. And according to his fiancée, Monica Daneman, he had been sobering up. He'd only tried, he snorted heroin maybe once or twice, according to his leading biographers. And basically, Monica Daneman and the leading biographer says he was getting very political in the last year of his life, last 2 years of his life. And and it's very suspicious, how they killed him. It's basically that he was murdered. It wasn't, it was a lot of foul play around that.
That's yeah. I Dave McGowan wrote a lot about that and about Jimi Hendrix, and apparently he had wine in his lungs.
Yeah, I mean, there's a
Yeah.
lot of different accounts, and people talk about wine in the lungs and all that, and that could be the case, but you don't need to get there's so much conjecture over all the little details. The key is that Mike Jeffrey admitted having him killed. How does someone have someone killed within 48 hours unless you're connected to the
Yeah,
intelligence community,
you mentioned a couple other deaths. Of course, we there's the assassination of John Lennon. The official narrative there is Mark David Chapman, apparently reading Catcher in the Rye, decides to shoot John Lennon. Of course, his connections to World Vision, that links to the Reagan assassination attempt as well. Interesting. And you also mentioned Kurt Cobain. You want to cover those two issues?
Yeah, sure. Fenton Bressler, a British attorney and longtime legal reporter for daily newspapers in Britain, wrote the definitive book, I think, on John Lennon, where he found, after studying his murder for 7 years, he found that the CIA basically used drugs and hypnosis to get Mark David Chapman to murder, John Lennon. Now, another book came out later by a longtime music critic in Britain, who also I forget his name off the top of my head, but he just added he agreed with Fenton Bressler, but he only added that there was another CIA agent there who had been part of a Cuban Cuban exile who was the security guard, coincidence at the same time that likely helped with that assassination of John Lennon.
Jose Perdomo, yeah.
And basically it was, John Lennon was, fitting the pattern of sobering up, getting more into activism, and then he's done away with for doing that. And Kurt Cobain is a more controversial case because people don't realize how, he was a radical leftist, and but also I argue that, again, you got that pattern of here's a guy who had serious major stomach problems, like horrible stomach ailments, and was I argue was psychologically profiled to fit the bill for if you turn him on to heroin, he'll go for it for a while. And he did, obviously. Courtney Love entered his life. Now, Courtney Love had an unbelievable history. She, her father told me, I interviewed her father for 2 hours to get all the basis for his facts in a book he had that said that his daughter helped murder Kurt Cobain. And so Harrison, I looked up his facts and found backing for the fact that he accidentally introduced his daughter when she was about 16, 17 years old to a guy who was actually an undercover CIA agent. That CIA agent then traveled with her, and she just so coincidentally happened to have 1,000 hits of acid on her that she brought to Ireland at 16 years old. And she just turned 17 while she was there. And then she travels with this CIA agent and his brother to the London music scene and gets and spreads acid like crazy there. Ends up going to all the top music scenes in different areas of the United States and spreads drug like candy. Spreads drugs like candy. And she was, Hank Harrison said, his daughter was a heroin addict and prostitute by the age of about 15 or 16 years old. Basically, his ex-wife had taken custody, sole custody of his daughter away from him because she was from Bausch and Lomb heirs, and they own gold mines and uranium mines. and were very wealthy and paid off his lawyers to throw the case. So he was very depressed when he lost custody of his child, Courtney Love. And then she calls him from a juvenile delinquent place in, near him, and he comes to her aid and gets her out of there, and finds out that he adopted a monster. He got hold of his daughter again. She had turned, she had turned into a monster. Now, Courtney Love, in her own memoirs, says that she was, I mean, basically in letters to Hank Harrison, she said that her therapist from infancy were having sex with her and giving her drugs that were MKUltra drugs, psychohypnotics. And at 13 years old, how did she know the names of all these psychohypnotic drugs that were given to her? So it's a really twisted, wild story. But basically, she even admitted to her first husband before Kurt Cobain, Courtney Love did, that she was a prostitute for generals in the army. And she was also a prostitute to David Packard, believe it or not. It was former assistant, assistant to defense secretary, and is famous from Hewlett Packard. And so she is a twisted, sick, dissociative individual who was, I argue, was inserted into Kurt Cobain's life, got him hooked on heroin, and then when he was divorcing her, according to her lawyer, who's on tape in the film Soaked in Bleach, he was divorcing her, getting her out of his life. He'd sobered up completely. And of course, that's according to blood tests. When he had a coma, when he went to a coma in Rome, the doctors did blood tests, and he had no illicit drugs in his system whatsoever, except for Rohypnol, which are called roofies, commonly known as roofies. And they were Courtney Love's prescription. And it appears that she dropped them into his drink to put him into a coma as the first attempt on his life. And he woke up from that. He hadn't been, he was sober for a year, he said, because he found an answer to his stomach problems. And he was divorcing her. And then, of course, he ends up dead.
And wasn't the amount of heroin found in him like too much? So he wouldn't be able to pull the trigger, right?
Yeah, it was over three times the amount that would kill a severe addict, the amount of opium in the system. Yeah, so the movie Soaked in Bleach outlines all that with the top experts. I mean, even the head of the Yale police, police department said they should reopen his case. But people like Cyril Wecht, who's a CNN, authority pathologist, has said that this was an incredible miscarriage of justice, the way they handled Kurt Cobain's case. To call it a suicide the same day is completely reckless and wrong. And he said, Cyril Wecht said it's highly unlikely that first his thing, he said he's in his 80s. He said he's never seen anyone kill themselves after shooting up with heroin. That doesn't happen, he says. But he says it's highly unlikely he could have possibly grabbed that gun, put away his drugs and his works in a kit, and then grabbed that gun and shot himself.
Yeah. I
Yeah,
mean, they die from an overdose. They don't die from a
exactly.
shooting
They
themselves.
usually die with a needle in the arm, right?
But just the tale that, here we have this another rocker, drugger,
Right.
dying, guns, and to the public at large, particularly the people who may not follow him, the music, the older generations, they're not going to care about the details. Another dead rock star,
Right, exactly. And then, again, it was another case of they tried to manipulate him to promote heroin, and it worked. The rise in heroin was huge in the early 1990s because of, their idol, Kurt Cobain, using heroin. And then when he sobered up and threatened to promote sobriety, he's done away with. Now, actually, the most interesting of, I think, of the cases I talk about in this book might be Tupac Shakur, that people may not realize, because of the fact that this fits into Catherine Austin Fitz, what we were saying about her earlier when we first started talking, not on tape, because Tupac Shakur was a revolutionary from birth. His parents were Black Panthers, leading Black Panthers. And he, when someone asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, when he was in like 12 years old, he said a revolutionary. And so he was head of a national black activist group called the New African Panthers when he was 17 years old. And he only hid his activism behind this gangster facade in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them to get them to turn on to activism and stop dealing drugs. And the problem with that was it was part of his Black Panther extended family's work to do that all over the country. And it was working. It was getting loads of gangs, thousands and thousands, I mean, literally tens of thousands of gang members across the country to stop dealing drugs. And that put a huge dent into the wallets of the CIA, the top drug traffickers. put a much huger dent into the banks and the other corporations that were laundering the money. Because the way Catherine Austin Fitz talks about it, she says that when a bank or a chain, a corporation launders money, it increases their stock value 20-fold because of the future. You know, you think that they're going to make for 20 years, they're going to make this, you know, higher level of cash or have this higher level of cash flow. So it increases the stock value hugely. So by getting tens of thousands of gang members to stop dealing drugs, you're literally affecting tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in laundered money and stock value. And that was why he had to be done away with, you know, and you know, sadly enough, at an early age.
And that's also why I think Gary Webb had to be done away with.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What he exposed with Iran-Contra was a part of that, too, because
right.
Not only was it the cocaine proceeds being used to fund the Contras, they were being funneled into the L.A. area with the crack cocaine. That was Freeway Ricky Ross.
Right.
And that gets back into the idea of drugs being used as an actual weapon as opposed to just as a way to raise money.
Right.
Exactly.
And Freeway Ricky Ross had two understudies, and one of them was named Michael Harry O'Harris. He was the founder of Death Row Records. And Death Row Records was the record cut label that kept trying to get Tupac to join them. And they finally convinced him to join them when Tupac was desperate in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so Death Row Records was a U.S. intelligence front company, basically. And they were doing the exact opposite of what Tupac was trying to do. Tupac was getting these gang peace truce movements to spread throughout the country and turning them into activism. Death Row was trying to do the exact opposite in Los Angeles, where that gang peace truce movement started between the Bloods and the Crips in Los Angeles. And they were actually employing Bloods and Crips and employing undercover police agents pretending to be Bloods and Crips and getting them to fight in the studios and actually kill each other at you know, rap concerts to try to end the peace truce in the L.A. area. It's really, you know, wild story.
Divide and conquer.
Yeah.
Divide and conquer. A good example, illustration of this relationship between high finance and drugs. Mike Rupert wrote about this, but also Catherine Austin Fitz does in her Narco Dollars for Beginners article. And it talks about Richard Grasso, chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, flew to Colombia to meet with the spokesperson for Raul Reyes of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, the supposed narco-terrorist. And the purpose of the trip was to bring messages of cooperation of the U.S. financial services and discuss foreign investment and future role of U.S. businesses in Colombia. She says, some reading in between the lines said to me that Grasso's mission related to the continued circulation of cocaine capital through the U.S. financial system. FARC, the Colombia rebels, were circulating their profits back into local development without the assistance of American banking and investment system. Worse yet, for the outlook for the U.S. stock market strength from $500 billion to $1 trillion in annual money laundering, FARC was calling for decriminalization of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives an idea to how important the drug trade is. It also keeps the banking system afloat because we have a banking system which is always on the verge of bankruptcy.
Oh, yeah. And
so the liquidity helps the bank system stay afloat, yeah.
Right. Within the last 5 or 10 years, you've had a number of the largest banks in the world, J.P. Morgan Chase, Fortune 500, just called them, within the last 2 years, the largest bank in the world. And remember, they were started by Julius Pierpont Morgan. The Pierponts were intermarried with the Russells. They were the top opium shipping and families in the world. And so this J.P. Morgan Chase was found to be laundering tons of drugs and laundering tons of drug money. And so they were fined, in a big way but not, nothing that was just, it was just really a drop in the amount of money they made off of laundering all that drug money. And then you got HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, which was started right after the Second Opium War. And that's the biggest bank in Europe. It's out of London. And they were found to be laundering hundreds of billions of dollars of money, and the leading authorities say when laundered money is virtually, it's hugely drug money.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's happening. And I talk about that, towards the end of my book, but towards the kind of middle of my book, I do talk about the fact that Latin America was targeted in particular by, after World War II, a lot of Nazis, like thousands of Nazis. New York Times even admitted this with the last few years, that thousands of Nazis were saved and sent down to Latin America. Now, why were they sent down there? They formed colonies in a number of different countries. And in those colonies, they formed power structures that were so, so powerful that planes weren't even allowed to fly over their area of the country. And so this happened in Chile, this happened in Argentina, and a number of other countries. You had Klaus Barbie and, you know, a lot of the famous, you know, top Nazis down there. And what were they doing? They were working with the CIA. And what were they doing? You know, they were part of the cocaine coups of Bolivia. They were, you know, they had there's a picture in Covert Action Quarterly of a Nazi flag flying in the Andes. Talking about the cocaine coup there. They were teaming up with the cocaine lords to topple countries and topple any democratically elected, you know, leaders and form their fascist dictatorships with the help of the CIA. And the biggest operation down there, you know, started with the toppling of Salvador Allende, the great leftist leader of Chile. He was one time doctor. And when they toppled him, Pinochet helped start Operation Condor with the CIA's help and with Argentina's help and with the Nazis' help that were down there. And they were drug trafficking up a storm and, you know, and killing leftists around the world, you know, along with drug trafficking around the world.
Yeah, I think it was William Colby. Yeah, William Colby, he said this in 1995. The Latin American drug cartels have stretched their tentacles much deeper into our lives than most people believe. It's possible they are calling the shots at all levels of the government. Coupled with that, the history of, I mean, what happened with World War II, you mentioned Klaus Barbie, Paperclip, and this, the rat line, the Nazis.
Yeah.
Of course, that a lot of that was Alan Dulles' work in Switzerland.
Dulles did that with help of the Vatican, too.
Yeah.
But it's funny because William Colby acts like, oh, yeah, they're controlling us, right? Colby and the oligarchs were certainly, you know, more in control of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and Colby's son, David Colby, actually infiltrated an encampment where Bob Marley was in Jamaica. CIA gave money and arms to some guys down in Jamaica to try to kill Bob Marley. They shot him. They didn't kill him. They also shot his wife and his manager, Don Taylor, according to Don Taylor's memoir. And then they David Colby infiltrated a camera group that were going to film a concert that Bob Marley was going to do, that was going to show support for his friend, the socialist, you know, leader of Jamaica at the time, in a very close election that where the CIA-backed guy was trying to take over Jamaica from the socialist leader Manley. And so this guy gets into the encampment and gives Bob Marley some gift shoes. And Bob Marley tries on the shoes and gets stabbed by a metal object. And one of the witnesses, Lee Lu Lee, was one of the other cameramen who happened to be a former Black Panther. He was half Asian, half Black. Said he didn't think of it anything of it at the time. But then Bob Marley toe was crushed playing soccer, and the doctor said he had cancer in that toe and spread throughout his body fast. And MKUltra had worked on chemicals that would bring on cancer as fast as possible. And the argument is, and there's evidence to support that, David Colby actually gave him a gift of shoes, knowing he'd try it on, and gave him a cancer through the cancerous, you know, MKUltra element within that way.
Yeah, that goes back to Jack Ruby, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, I heard that they did that with him, sure.
That was Dr. Mary's Monkey.
That's a great Trinde book, yeah.
Yeah, about the weaponization. Of course, that goes back to the polio vaccinations. And the
It's a whole other can of worms.
I
love that book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, but it's hard to know. You know, it's a wild book. I think it's true. It's hard to know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's quite a contention. It's well done, though.
We don't have the luxury of certainty in a lot of these things. We have a lot of inferences and follow the evidence best we can. Well, I think we covered pretty much it. I mean, we've the drug trade, the rise of oligarchs, the weaponization of drugs, the use of celebrities, the abuse of celebrities.
Yeah, it's just sad. It's sad that I have SDS and Panthers in the title and the subtitle of my book, and it's very sad the way such a great group. The Students for a Democratic Society and the Black Panthers were both targeted with drugs to kind of destabilize them.
Drugs and Asian provocateurs, from what I
know. Oh, yeah, tons of Asian provocateurs, sure. And it's too bad that such great groups were brought down that way. Well, you know, but they were also just targeted physically, too, when the Black Panthers were assassinated.
Oh, yeah, Freddie Hampton,
too,
the murder. Yeah.
Right, sure. So, but it's happening today, too, to the Occupy. You know, I showed my last chapters, it was happening, you know, the Occupy movement was targeted. And God knows how many other great activist groups are targeted in different ways with both drugs and in other ways, yeah.
Well, any meaningful or group organization that has some potential to affect change is going to be targeted by the establishment. They're not going to sit back and play by, you know, play fair. They're going
Sadly to, enough,
you know, and they have the resources to do it.
Right, and then the only thing, the thing I argue in, with my book is that at least with drugs, at least we can take control of our own bodies and not let ourselves get targeted in that way. You know,
well, that's the ultimate psyop, because a lot of people think they're taking on the system, you know, taking on the man and saying, you know,
right,
by doing drugs, but actually you're actually funding the system.
Exactly. You're funding it. You're,
yeah,
you're cooperating with their agenda. You're hurting your own mind. You know, you're making yourself less competent to do the best activism, all of that. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm against prohibition. I'm also against drug use.
And yeah, exactly.
I don't think that's a contradiction.
I agree.
Really look into it. If you really,
I totally agree, Tim.
So, well, listen, I want to thank you for coming on my show. It's great. I said I only have you for an hour, so I want to be respectful of your time.
Thanks so much, Tim.
And I think we, with the time we had, we covered a lot. It was a very concise, crisp interview. I want to thank you for it.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
And all I can say is go buy his book. It's Weapons Against Us, the series.
Drugs as Weapons Against Us, right?
I'm sorry. Yeah, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the series. Murders, Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and other activists. His other book specifically deals with Tupac Shakur. That's a great story in and of itself. That's the FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, which published in 2007. You have a website?
Yeah, sure. It's drugsasweapons.com. But you can find my book in Barnes & Noble. If they don't have it on the shelf, they say they'll get it on the shelf within 2 or 3 days for you, or they'll order, you know, get it in the store within 2 or 3 days. And but it's also, of course, available immediately on Amazon and Trine Day's website.
Great. Okay. Well,
it's also available, of course, with signed copies from my website, drugsasweapons.com.
Sure. Do you prefer people buy directly from you?
If they wouldn't mind, sure.
Yeah. I mean, it helps support the author. So
thanks a lot, Tim. Yeah.
Great. Listen. Thanks, John. I'll say goodnight and let you enjoy what remains of it. So there you go.
Thanks again, Tim. Take care now.
Take care. Thanks.